I'm Gary Brown. I'm an alcoholic. My dry date's the 3rd of December, 1964. Who would have dreamed that the reading of the traditions would be the highlight of the conference? There just couldn't have been a better mistake. Now, I tried to top it this morning. I thought I was supposed to be down here at 10. So I owe Shelly an amend. She knocks on my door, and I grab my coat and we come down here. And I couldn't have got away from her. I lost the circulation in my arm. She had to. So my apologies to you. I don't know what I'm saying. Cornelia, you were a wonderful pickup. she picked me up at the airport. It was a great time. Chris hosted me at his home Thursday night, and we sat out in the front yard at night and smoked a cigar. And I'm not sure a cigar is worse sitting out at what is it, 0 degrees and smoking a cigar, but we got it done. I think I cut it short. Anyway, on December 3rd, 1964, I found myself at the door of a facility known as the Wyoming State Hospital. In 1964, it was a hospital. They effectively were making the transition from an asylum to a hospital. So from this point on, I'll be referring to that place as the Nut House, because effectively that's what it was. But when I got there, I had no idea the shape I was in. I'll back up a little bit. I was 6'2" tall. I weighed something less than 130 pounds, and I didn't know I was dying. The night before, I had been invited to return home. I had been dismissed from there for bad behavior. And I had called to see if I could see our daughters, and my wife said, yeah, come on up. And I thought, geez, I got it made. I'm back in the house, you know. I get to get back in the big bed and all that stuff. And when I walked in the door, her dad was there. And we had that talk. I know none of you have ever had that talk. But in this particular discussion in 1964, there wasn't much awareness of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only thing they knew to do with someone like me, who every time he tried to stop drinking was unable to do it, and when he started drinking, couldn't control the amount I'd take. And but all I knew is Julie's uncle, my wife's uncle, her dad's brother, took a trip up to the Nut House frequently. And they would keep him for various lengths of time and bring him back, and he'd drink again and go back. But that's all they knew to do. This was sent us to the Nut House. And so they asked if I'd go, and I agreed to, and I told her dad, I said, well, I'll go if you'll take me. Hell, it's only 400 miles. I didn't think it was inconvenient. And he said, no, but I'll take you down and put you on the bus. And I said, okay. Years later, Julie and I and the girls are up at their grandparents having a Thanksgiving dinner. And Julie's dad asked me if I remembered that day that I went to the Nut House. And I said, yeah, I think I remember most of it. Why? He said, I just want you to know I didn't care which bus you got on, just as long as you didn't shine. But I got on it, and for one brief stop in Rock Springs, Wyoming, I went and bought a bottle to make it through the rest of the trip. And found myself in there, and then I learned some interesting things. They put me in the alcoholic ward, which was me and probably 25 or 30 other men, because I'd answered the question correctly. They asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic, and I looked at the place I was in, and that seemed to be the best choice. And so anyway, that's effectively how I ended up there. And I had my first acquaintance of Alcoholics Anonymous there, because we are a program of attraction, right? And they made it real clear that I could go to the AA meeting or change wards. So I was attracted to AA. And that was that. They had to keep me there, and so I could withdraw from the alcohol. And back then they used some drugs that they no longer use today, and that's probably kept more of us alive than anything else. But won't go into that. But I went to that first meeting finally, and it was a barred facility, locked doors. And I'm looking out the window, looking out in the parking lot, and I'm seeing cars driving in, and they're supposedly AA members who'd driven up from Salt Lake City or up from the little town of Evanston. And I told this guy next to me, I don't believe they're alcoholics. I said, I don't know who these people are, but they can't be alcoholics. He said, why is that? And I said, look at those cars. I said, they have chrome strips on both sides. One-piece windshields. And some of them had both headlights. It was incredible. But they came, and I don't remember much of what they said and all that. I know when they came to ask, and the guys that were in there, you went around the room to talk, and it was, I'm Gary, I'm an alcoholic, and I pass. And I'm Joe, and I'm an alcoholic, and I pass. And we went through 30 guys in about 3 minutes, four. And so we'd go, and I thought, well, that's exciting. But by the time I'd left there and did some more meetings, there was a change in my life. I did find out I was an alcoholic, and I found out that that wasn't a choice. Our book's pretty clear. We've lost the power of choice. And isn't it interesting? It never tells us that we get it back. Yeah. And I'm sober a long time. I've been through the 12 steps in order. I don't know how many times through the big book. And I still don't have a choice. And later on in the 10th steps, it seems we couldn't drink even if we wanted to. And I think that's a promise here. I think it is. The day that I remember, I'm sitting down. Somebody said, I think it was Polly last night, talking about it. As a youngster, and long before she drank, she could lie at the drop of a cap. Yep, boom. That was me. I was a liar long before I got a hold of alcohol. You know, it kind of greased it. You could get better with it. And we're sitting around, six or eight of us are sitting around a round table there. Thank you. And they were talking about what they were going to do when they were going to get out. And I remember the one old boy, he was going to go back to Fort Bridger and try to get the ranch back. Another buddy was going to try to get his business back. They were all going to go do things. The guy's going to go back out in the oil patch and start making the big money again so they can go out and do this all over, I guess. And they're going around. It got to me, and I'm sitting there thinking, I'm in a room full of has-beens here. Then it struck me that I was a never was. I really hadn't done a damn thing, so... But they stopped and they're looking at me like it was my turn to say something. And I said, you know, I don't have a clue what I'm going to do when I get out of here. All I know is I never want to take another drink. And I never had that thought before in my life. I'd heard myself say that. And of course, I qualified to be an AA member then. I didn't know that then either. But that was kind of a surprise to me. I really didn't want to drink anymore. My life up until that point had been waking up with a hole in my belly and the wind blowing through it. And it was just awful. It was just awful. And it'd get worse until you could get a drink to help it to die down a little bit, you know. I'd go down to the Redwood Bar and write them a bad check for $5 and get a shot and a beer. Drink the beer, go throw it up, and come back and drink the whiskey. And in a little while, you feel about 10% better, you know. And then maybe you have another one, have a little bit better than that. And you get to thinking, one more and I'm going to catch my edge. you know, I'm going to hit that spot where everything's just right. You know, I'm everything I think I can be. And I'm right past it. Boom. Just shot right by. And then I'm out on the run again, and I'm out of liquor, and I got to go find a bar that'll take another bad check. And the reason for that was I didn't have an account, a bank account. They had these traveler, what they call them, counter checks that sat on the back bar there. And you could, which bank? Didn't matter. Name a bank. And so anyway, I find out about AA there, and I do discover, I think, going to those silly meetings, that I say that because I really didn't relate to a lot of that. I had no experience with God. God in my house where I grew up was a swear word. We didn't know anything about it. I know my dad would be really upset with people who knocked on the front door in hopes of bringing us into the fold. And we stayed unfolded. And so by the time they're coming around, they're taught, these people are talking in AA about getting up in the morning, praying. You know, I just didn't know anybody that did that. But I did know we lived next door to us was a Mormon family. And where we lived in Wyoming, it's mostly drought. A big year of moisture might be 15 or 16 inches. And so if it decides not to rain, it gets real dry and stuff dies. And it was going on. And I remember my dad would stop our neighbor, our Mormon neighbor, and ask him to pray for rain. So the disbelieving dad must have had some kind of belief, you know. Sometimes it rained. And but I was still uncomfortable with that and had no reason for that. I had no acquaintance with any kind of religion or religious, and but it sent something crawling up my back, and I couldn't figure out what it was. But I noticed there that some of these people could do things I couldn't do. They could look you in the eye while they were talking to you. I was incapable of doing that. I couldn't carry on a conversation. If I was, I was looking at my shoes or the ground or kicking rocks or something. And but these people had something going for them, and some of them told some horrible stories, and I could relate to a lot of them, particularly if they talked about what happened when they drank and how awful it was when we were sober, when I was sober. I could relate to that. The pain of being sober is terrible for the alcoholic, and if we don't find something or hit that point where we'll do anything to get sober and stay sober, we're screwed. We're in serious trouble. And I related to that. Oh, I really didn't do sober very good at all. I couldn't stand it. I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't fit anywhere. I couldn't do anything. Pauline and Dave and everybody here has talked about not fitting, about the desire to be recognized and to be a part of and to fit in. In that nut house, there was a man there, not an alcoholic, named Dale. And Dale was a very large man. And I don't mean just fat. He was tall, he was big, and the only clothes they found there to fit him were bib overalls and work shirts or T-shirts that he could wear under. And Dale would come into the canteen, the coffee shop there, and he'd come in and he'd sit down and he'd say, "I milked me some cows out in the barn this morning. How do you like me for that?" Or, "I helped in the cafeteria this morning and I handed out the trays so the people could eat. How do you like me for that?" Or he had done this and he'd done that and he'd ask, "How do you like me for that?" And we were coming up on Christmas time and Dale was coming in the canteen elated that he was going to get to go home for Christmas. They were going to come get him and take him to ranch for Christmas. "How do you like me for that?" And he was just delighted with that. So Christmas came, and I noticed before Christmas Day was over, Dale was back, and they locked him up on a locked ward, a very locked ward. We didn't see him for a while. And he came back down later on, and he walked into the canteen, and he sat down, and he's holding a Christmas present. And looking at the wrapping, it had been wrapped and unwrapped and wrapped and unwrapped again and again. And he sat down there and he said, I got some new underwear for Christmas. How do you like me for that? Well, Dale had gone home, and it was so exciting for Dale to be there with the people where he wanted to belong so badly, and his little sister came up to hug him, and he picked her up, and he hugged her, and he crushed her. And so they threw him back in the truck, and they took him back to the nut house. What else would you do? And I think that I'm just short of killing somebody when I'm demanding that same kind of self-centered attention. In that song, I never really thought about that till I was sober for quite a while. I forgot about Dale for a while, until I found myself thinking, if not saying, "How do you like me for that?" Sitting in conversations, just talking about how wonderful I've been in as an AA member. You know, I'm sponsoring umpty-nine people, or whatever it is. How do you like me for that? And so when Polly was talking about that last night, I was relating very much, and thought I'd share that. Dale was a great lesson for me. But I didn't catch on to it very quick. They let me in. There was a 16-week program. It wasn't extraordinarily long for me. Most of the alcoholics got out of there in 4 months. It was not a spin dry. And I got on the bus to ride back, and it was, I don't remember, probably a 400 miles back then was at least 6-7 hours or more. Hell, that'd be longer than that. And I remember I wasn't even halfway back, and I had the hole in my belly as the wind blowing through again. I was sober, hadn't had anything to drink. There was a possibility I was going to be going to college. I say that because they came up to me last week or so. I was in there, and they said, "Gary, you know, there's a deal here where you can go to college if you want to, and we'll pay you enough money to maintain your wife and your children, buy all your books and tuition, if you think you'd want to do that." Well, the option was to go look for a job. So, hell yes, I'm going to go do that. And so took them up on that, and my wife and three daughters moved to Laramie to do that. And I learned something else there. There was AA in Laramie. There was a meeting on Monday and a meeting on Friday if somebody else showed up. And so I started showing up at those. There weren't many members, and came in there, and they needed a new secretary treasurer, and they made me it. But that was great. I really needed the money. I somehow survived that time there. I'd go to the meetings down there and make the coffee often, and there wouldn't be anybody show up. So I'd have a 30-cup pot of coffee that there. I thought I had to drink it all myself. I'm surprised I have any kidneys left. And I'd drink that coffee, and I'd look out the window, waiting for people to show up. And the Buffalo Bar was across the street. They had one of those neon lights that would flash, Buffalo, Buffalo. The B was out. Damn thing said, Uffalo, Uffalo. And I'd sit there and I'd grab the arm of the chair and my knuckles would turn white. And I said, "God, don't let me take a drink. I can't stand this much longer. What am I going to do?" And so I kept going. I was afraid to take any time off from college. I didn't take any vacations. I got a 4-year degree in 3. Ended up with a job with an oil company in Denver. And I moved down there with Julie and the kids, and we found a place to live, and they had meetings every day of the week down there, but I don't remember anybody ever saying do 90 meetings in 90 days. I really don't. Hell, up there in Laramie in my first 3 years, I'll tell you what, I don't know how many miles that I had to put on my car to do 90 meetings in 90 days. Probably more than the delegate in this area here. That guy's got to put, or gal's got to put some miles on the car, don't they? Jeez. I found an AA group quite by accident. A friend of mine had met in this one meeting we'd found. We sat in this meeting, and it was a bunch of seemingly very old AA members in there that I kind of felt they probably had to stay sober because their life was shot anyway. And they were always patting me on the back and saying something like, Gary, it's just so great you got a hold of this thing so young and you didn't have to go through everything we had to do to get here. And I think just a damn minute. I've nearly died doing this thing. I don't got another one of these left. I know that. I'm lucky to have made the last one. And now they meant well, and I understand that, but it still ticked me off. And so we were, just Joe and I were meeting in one afternoon at his kitchen table, eating, drinking a cup of coffee and rewriting the big book and bitching about the people in that group. When his wife said that we were the two most miserable people, boy, did I clean that up, she had ever seen in her life, and she didn't want us around there. She says, I don't care what you do, get out of here. She says, there's a young people's meeting downtown. Why don't you go try that? And so Joe gets all puffed up, and he says, yeah, Brown, let's do that. He says, the babes there got to be better looking anyhow. He swears to this day that's why we went. But well, they were. But I heard a lingo in there I hadn't heard in 3 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, going on four. They talked about taking the 12 steps in order. You know. Gee, Brown, the reason they put numbers in front of those steps is so a dummy like you will know which one to take next. And so they talked the steps, and they talked a little different language than that heard it all. And they talked about going to lots of meetings because that's what they did. And I thought for sure I'd come in there, crowding for your sobriety. I figured I was sober longer than most of them in there, and I could tell them how the cow ate the cabbage. They weren't listening. And but they talked about the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and doing what it said. And I pretty much missed it. But more and more, I would go to meetings. The meetings we'd go to, they would celebrate somebody having completed a step. You know, and somebody may stand up and say, I took my fifth step today. And they'd get a round of applause and they'd congratulate. Because many of them knew what happens with a lot of us when we take the fifth step. Some of us coming out feeling better than we've ever felt in our lives. You know, booze never got me that high. So anyway, there's this stuff going on. And a few of the guys there and the gals decided that they were going to start a separate meeting, and that's what we were going to do. We were going to go through the book and the steps together and do what it said while we did it. And so we started this big meeting. We didn't have many places to meet, so we met out at one of the guys' homes. He lived on Goat Hill. It's because of the goats. You watched where you stepped when you went up the porch. And the place is jam-packed. It was just, there was all kinds of AA members in there. And all we knew to do was open the book at the beginning. And so we did. We opened at the foreword of the first edition and read about the first 100 men who have recovered from this seemingly hopeless condition. And we talked through that, and what did that mean? We didn't know. We knew that we certainly weren't recovered. You don't wake up in the morning with that kind of pain in your stomach and have recovered from a damn thing. And so, but we read on through it and answered the questions. I learned more about my alcoholism when I read the doctor's opinion. And then we got up to the first portion of the third chapter, more about alcoholism. There's a paragraph in there that says, we learned we had to concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. This is delusion. Excuse me. This is the first step to recovery. The delusion or anything like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. And we read that one night. And something changed. It was kind of like I'd been handed the keys to the kingdom. And I don't know what it was, and I don't know how to describe it either, but I understood that I was powerless over alcohol. I can't do nothing with it or without it. I'm powerless over it. Can't not drink because I'm powerless over it, and I can't stop if I start because I'm powerless over it. If that's not powerless, what is? And for some reason, I was starting to get a handle on having an unmanageable life. And I think the first thing I thought of back then is I remembered a time I was trying to tell my dad what I felt like. And I said, Dad, I'm scared. He said, aw, what do you got to be scared of? So I never told anybody that again. for a long time. We went on. I got a real handle there. And then we went on into the fourth chapter, we agnostics, and we were talking about coming to believe. Tom showed up there. Tom was my favorite member of the group. He was just crazy. He and I would sit and laugh and dream up crazy stuff. And you know how healthy that laughter is when we first come in? Those nutcases that came in who loved to laugh and could get me going were wonderful to me. I got some relief. I didn't know it was there. It was just so powerful. And Tom came in like there, and he was probably in his mid-20s when he showed up there. And he's talking in a meeting, and he's sharing with us that when he was 19, he'd been locked in a place called Mount Airy. Isn't that a great name for a nut house? Mount Airy for the airheads. they had a thing called the aversion treatment there. And I suppose there's some people up here that know what that is, but it's a medieval thing. It's done a few places still, however. And it went like this. It's a hospital setting, but they had a treatment room, and that room was just a room, maybe 12, 14 foot square. In the middle of the room is a barber type chair, and attached to one arm of the chair is a stainless steel pot. It'll swivel in front of or away from whoever's in the chair. The walls are lined with mirrors, and shelves are attached to the walls, and there's all kinds of different kinds of liquor bottles sitting on the shelves. And they gave Tom some antabuse and took him in there and sat him down and said, "You can have anything you'd like to drink." So what they're doing there is getting you to drink on top of the antabuse, and then you can see yourself in the mirror as you become violently ill. You know, you're throwing up, your eyebrows are falling out, your toenails are curling, and you're just going to be so adverse to it, you're never going to take another drink. And when Tom came to us, he said it had worked. It really had. He hadn't had reason or excuse to take antabuse since. I just came to believe by sitting in AA meeting and watched some really sick puppies get well. You know that? I did. These alcoholic kids would come in here and just crazy. One of the guys that came in there was trying to make a living working as a cashier in a porno shop. And amidst all that fantasy and trying to get a handle on God is a little difficult, I think. But he made it. Last I saw him, he was sober, and that was a long time ago. We got moved along. Now, somehow the girls left that group of us that were going through the book together. I don't know why. I didn't do it. I saw one of them last over, and she says, "I don't remember why." But it came down to 14 guys. And so we're moving on into the fifth chapter, and we're reading all the stuff about the actor, and we're getting up there, and it's talking to us about the third step prayer. And little Lee, one of the guys there, said he had an idea. He wanted for us to join hands and read/pray that third step prayer together. And he said the reason that he wanted to do that was because he'd been to a bunch of AA meetings a couple of weeks before that, and many of them were on inventory. And he would ask people who said they hadn't written an inventory, he'd ask them why. And many of them said, "Well, I'm not taking the third step yet." And so when he came in back into that meeting, he wanted all of us to say the third step prayer together, and then in case somebody heard him a week or two later telling him that he hadn't started an inventory because he hadn't taken the third step yet, we could call him a damn liar because we saw him do it. And that's the kind of lingo we understood. So that's what we did. Back in there, and it was probably about 69 or 70. It really wasn't cool for a room full of boys to hold hands. And in my case, it really wasn't cool to be seen praying. But we did that. And I did it because they were doing it. I had to be a part of, so that's why I did it. Might have saved my life. But I did it, and as we're driving home that night, I said, "God, make that prayer real. I really mean it. I can't stand this much longer. It's just awful. Now, two things happened there, and you can do with what you want with it. I've lost which came first. There was a man in Denver named a Big Frank McKibben. And he was one of the most intimidating guys I'd ever met. He was a lawyer, and so he's incredibly well-spoken. He could cut you half in half of words. And he was intimidating physically. And he wanted to explain something to me. He'd go like this, "Kid." Had a little bruise. Monkey. He was sitting in a meeting I'd gone to. I just sat at the meeting. It was just a meeting. I don't remember it being spectacular and all that. After we said the prayer, Frank and I were sitting next to each other, and we were there, one's left, and we're sitting there in the room. He said, "What do you want, kid?" I says, "I'm here to tell you I'm no longer scared of you one damn bit." And I said, "I've taken a third step, and I don't think you can hurt me anymore." Boy, was that stupid. But he laughed. He laughed out loud. And he hugged me. And it was a hug, I'll tell you. And I walked out to the car. And I got in the car. And I sat in the car, and my fanny didn't hit the seat. Anybody had that experience? Where you're just there, and the stuff's around you? Now, Julie and I had made a deal that night that I'd hurry home from the meeting and watch the kids so she could go to an Al-Anon meeting. And so I hustled home. She'd already tucked them into bed. And so I went in and was kissing the girls goodnight. And they had three separate rooms, and the youngest one was downstairs, and the two older girls were upstairs. And I got to their middle daughter, Patty, and she had been diagnosed with ulcers at probably about 3 years old, four. And she was crying. I said, "You want me to go get some milk?" She said, "Please." And so I went down and got it and came back up. She's drinking that milk a little bit. And I had taken a new job with some real nutcases working in there. They prayed to start the day. And they were talking about all this crazy stuff, laying on of hands and that. They were trying to convince me that we had to do it their way or God wouldn't answer prayers. And I'm sitting there sober. Sorry, Charlie. But I didn't say much in the end. But I asked Patty, I said, "Should we ask God to do something about your tummy?" And she said, "Please." And so I can't tell you what I said. All I can tell you is I held her with one hand and I put my other hand on her tummy. And when I opened my eyes, she was sound asleep. So I went downstairs and just sat there with this, still had this feeling about me, whatever it was, and went to bed. And nothing came of that for a while. And later on, 3 or 4 months later maybe, Julie was in fixing dinner. And we eat a lot of hot foods, Mexican foods preferably, and we're as good as most of Chicanos in the south side of Denver as cooks. But she was fixing that, and one of the girls asked what we were going to have for dinner. And Julie told them, and they said, "Well, what's Patty going to eat?" "She can't do that." Patty says, "I can too. My tummy hadn't hurt for a long time." So do what you want with that, but those happen. I went home one night and after a meeting and wrote my inventory. First time I tried it, I opened my big book and I tried to follow example in there, and I'm not sure I knew what I was doing. But I started to understand what it meant by selfishness and self-centeredness. I don't think I had it clear. And somebody says, "Gary, selfishness means it's mine and you can't have it. Self-centeredness is it's yours and I'm fixing to get it." Okay? That's a great handle. Think about it. There is a difference. And so anyway, I did the best I could at doing that. I wrote all night. And next morning I got up and I put the pencil down because there wasn't any more to write. I was just done. But I didn't know who I was going to take the fifth step. There was a guy in the young people's group named Ernie, big, good-looking Hispanic guy, and we didn't like each other. And back there, that wasn't unusual at that point in time in our lives. But he had disappeared. He dropped out of sight. People were saying, "Where's Ernie?" And I said, "Don't knock it. He's gone." But he came back, and there was something different about Ernie. And I don't know how to explain that other than I looked him in the eye and there was somebody home. Hadn't seen anybody there before. So he got down and talked that he'd gone down to a place called Liquidney, Texas. And you don't know it up here in that, but you guys are probably descendants of a guy named Bob White that lived there. Him and Chuck and some of those guys were great buddies and they did a lot for us. But he... got in touch with Bob, and Bob sat him down and had him write an inventory. And then Ernie said he was done in a couple of days. And Ernie loved to fish. So Bob says, "Well, let's go out in the big boat out in the middle of the lake." And they got out in the lake, and Bob turned the boat off and put the keys in his pocket. And he says, "Why don't you tell me what's in that inventory?" Ernie can't swim, so he took a fifth step. So when he came back, somebody had moved in there that hadn't been there before. And you could see a profound change. Physically could see it. And so a bunch of us were going to go down to a little AA conference in southeast Colorado. And we were leaving a little late to go to it. But Ernie and I and a lady named Mary were going to ride down there together. And when we got there, there was only two rooms left. And there were three of us. And I had high hopes of rooming with Mary, but got Ernie. You know, the peace sign was the thing that was in back then. It was, you know, you'd see the peace sign, like, and you'd walk into an AA meeting, and everybody would be hugging and saying hello and all that, and Ernie and I'd see each other across the room, give each other the peace sign. That's as close as we were getting. He's missing this finger. That's only one reason I didn't like it. But I ended up rooming with Ernie down there, and he knew I had this inventory sitting there and letting it fester because I wasn't telling anybody about it. And so I looked around. I didn't see anybody else there I was going to take it with, so I took it with him. And that Sunday morning, they asked me to get up and share my story. And so I shared up to this point in my story that I'd gotten this far. And all I can tell you about that is a lady came up to me afterwards and she said, "Gary, I think I've known you since you showed up in Denver." And I said, "Yeah, Lynn, I think that's right." She says, "There was something different about your story." And she didn't finish the sentence. And she says, "I know. This time you told the truth." And she was right. And I never felt better in my life. I had a few days there where I felt so good I just quit doing the program. I was going to meetings, but I was sharing a little bit of that. And we were very active at 12-stepping people. We would go up to the Denver General Hospital and go to the detox ward. That's because they'd let you in there. We'd just see if anybody wanted to get sober. We'd just ask them. We'd look for the younger guys in there to do it with. And we were always doing that. And I was so involved in that 12-step activity that things seemed to be going real well. Except the job wasn't going real well. I was with, I'd become after we'd taken the fifth step and that, my life changed enough and I was invited to go to a work in a business I wouldn't have touched at a bet, because I didn't think I was at all capable of it. I didn't think I was at all capable of much. Mo came up to me, or I came in here to get my badge here, I guess, my name, and he said, "Well, you've always known who you are, haven't you?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, I think I have always known who I am. I was just so incredibly disappointed." I guess I could have saved about 10, 15 minutes talking here if I'd have thought of that earlier. I had a little trouble with the business, and it was falling apart, and my partner had left the business and for a year or so to recover from cancer, and when she came back, she didn't like the way I'd run it, and we just couldn't seem to make it work as a partnership or a business of that anymore. And I came home one night, and Julie and I said a prayer wanting to know what to do. What are we going to do about the business? And the very next morning, a man named Don, who I'd met in Young People's early on, but who had moved to various places around the country, but he called me from Nashville, Tennessee. And he says, I'm not sure why I'm calling. But I was in my morning meditation, and he says, the only thing I can think of is I need a salesman to come out here and work in the Midwest and sell music, commercial music, jingles, stuff like that. Call on whoever would use them in the media, the radio or television. And that night I went to my home group, and the young people's group, and I told them about this call. I said, do you think that's an answer of prayer? And this young lady off a ranch in Kansas was in there, and she says, sure beats hell out of a bolt of lightning, doesn't it? And so effectively, oversimplifying it, we ended up selling the house and moving to Indianapolis. And that's what I did. And when I got to Indianapolis, things were different. I'm away from my cocoon of young people in AA, and we were tight, and we were together often. Anything we did together. You just did it. You went on 12-step calls together. We'd go out after the meetings at night and go up to Bauer's Restaurant and overdose on coffee and ice cream and stay up late and laugh and have the greatest of times. And all that was gone, and we're in a part of the country that's completely different. They're very laid back. Denver was made up mostly of people who had transplanted there, and Indianapolis was made up mostly of natives who lived within a block or two of their parents, it seems like. And they were friendly enough, and they were nice enough, and you went to the meetings, they were great, but you never saw them anywhere else or after the meetings. They just didn't do that. And when I moved there, there was 50 meetings a week going there. And back then, that was just a small smokestack city. Today, it's about the same size as Calgary, about 1.5 million people. But they were all speaker meetings of the 50 meetings they had. They didn't have discussion meetings there. Now we have 520 AA meetings a week, and there's 50 speaker meetings. Boy, have we screwed that up. We think we get well by talking. Got it backwards, don't we? We got to hear something. We got to listen. And I say that around Indianapolis. They just think I'm an old dinosaur. You know, I guess I am. I have no experience with drugs. I've never smoked a joint. I've never stuck anything or my arm or anywhere else. I just don't have any experience with it. And every once in a while this kind of comes up because we're bending our primary purpose in AA, whether you think so or not, we are. A drug is not a drug is not a drug. I have taken pills personally for two or three surgeries and all that. And most cases I took one or two of the prescription they sent me home with and either gave them away or flushed them and all that because ibuprofen worked better. It didn't put me to sleep. I don't think there's a difference. I'm very clearly an alcoholic. Years ago in Denver, David talked about a man named Don that was in Denver who started the Fellowship of the Spirit conference. And Don was one of those guys that I took him to his first general service quarterly, and it was a very contentious meeting, and I brought him, we're driving back to Denver from it. He says, that was awful. I don't ever want to do that again. As trustee, he took AA into Russia several years later and tells a wonderful story. But when he was first in the young people's meeting, the hip thing at the time to say, I'm an alcoholic and a drug abuser, or I'm an alcoholic and a drug fiend, and stuff like that. And all of a sudden I noticed that Don and some of these other people are just introducing themselves as alcoholics. And I said, tell me about that. What's going on? He says, I'm not a drug addict. He said, I had no choice about drinking. I had to drink, but I set the drugs down and walked away time after time. What set him free was the jitter joints talking about our drug of choice. Our problem is the drug of no choice. Think about it. If you can walk away from one and set it down. I got a grandson to do that. He loves to get off on crack, but he can't stop drinking. He doesn't drink at all. And in his case, Don was a guy who used to love to go out on the reservation and do peyote with the Indians and that. And even back then, he found a way to... Meth was his drug of choice. He loved that high better than anything. But he would walk away from it, but he couldn't stop drinking with that. Now, that doesn't mean that's true with all of us, of all of those who had experiences. And I understand that. But I do believe that we are, most of us are either one thing or the other. We're not both. That doesn't mean an alcoholic like myself can take pills or stick anything in my arm or anywhere else or things. It doesn't mean that. But we're losing our primary purpose. Now, I understand that I'm a dinosaur who's never had drugs in his system that way. I can tell you my home group has a number of young people who have tried drugs and didn't like it. It didn't do what booze did for them, and they couldn't stop drinking. So our primary purpose is still as incredibly needed as it ever has been. And I swore them down. I wasn't going to get into that tonight. But sermon over. My wife says she wants to smoke some dope before she dies. And she said, I want to try that marijuana before I go and all that. And I says, well, you got 5 grandsons there. I'm sure any one of them can help you out. And Corey, one of the grandsons, says, Grandpa, quit saying that. I'm not scoring no dope for Grandma. So anyway... I found myself in trouble in Indianapolis, and I was actively going to meetings and working with people and doing all of that, but I've lost some direction I had in AA. I'm chipping on my wife. I'm having difficulty making a living. About everything I can do in society in general, let's just say our lives are made up of 3 things. I say money, power, and sex. I don't think I missed anything, did I? I was screwed up. And so I hit the point there where I hit a point there where I was desperate again. And I called a man in Chicago named Paul M., who died 2 years ago at 62 years sober. And the day he died, he was as bad a step Nazi as he'd been his whole time. But I'd known of him and knew him for a long time, and I called him. And I asked him if he believed there's any such thing as a 44-year-old alcoholic with 20 years sobriety could be going through male menopause. And he said, well, maybe. But if you review your first 3 steps again, write another inventory and come up here and take some 5th steps and make amends, you'll feel better. And I said, I'll do anything you say. And I meant it. I think I was more desperate to do something at that point than I'd ever been in my life. And so I did that. I went home and wrote an inventory. Now, I've been taking people through the book and the steps in order, reading it and going along. And I do the inventories with them. I'm not there as a teacher. And I share it with them. And that's the way we do it. So I've done a lot of inventory writing. So I sat down this time, and my resentment list was all current stuff. Now, that ought to scare the hell out of you. That means I can cause as much harm stone sober as I ever did drunk. My fear inventory was all current stuff. And I was able to understand it better. I think it's fair to say that. And my conduct inventory, I went back as far as I could go, as far as I could remember. And I asked those 9 questions that came up on either one. The primary question is, was it selfish or not? Was I there? And I called Paul, told him I was done writing the inventory, and he said, well, come on up here, out in Chicago in LaGrange. And he said, gave me the name of a motel to be at, and and to be there before 4 o'clock. And I got there with just enough time before 4 o'clock to run across the street to the gas station and get a cup of coffee. And came back to the room, and there's a knock on the door. And I opened the door, and there's a guy named Dennis O'Brien there. He said he's 29 years sober, and he's there to swap fifth steps with me. And he walked in carrying a three-ring binder, looked a lot like the one I had, takes the only chair in the room, and sits down, and he says, "I'm going to go first so you'll know what to do." And he opens up the ring binder, and he reads inventory to me. And when he's done, I sat down and opened mine up, and I read inventory to him. Now, they're very much the same. And we both had a lot of experience writing inventory. We could write down the inventory and omit most of the drama. We're getting down to what we're talking about: selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear. And we're getting those taken care of. How did that affect me? Yeah, my self-esteem. What was I doing there? What was I trying to do? And we'd go through that quickly. And I don't think we were there much more than maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. And compared notes. I'd found some things he'd missed and vice versa. And we shook hands and he left, and I'd never seen Dennis since. He died not long after that. Another guy knocked on the door, said his name is Chuck, he's 21 years sober, and he's there to swap fifth steps with me. He comes in, takes the only chair in the room, and sits down and says, "I'll go first so you know what to do." So we do the same thing. By noon Sunday, I've done that 9 times. We're down to people with 2 or 3 years of sobriety. But they had more in the program than I had. They had all been involved if they weren't done making their amends. With them. We did that same process. So anyway, at noon Sunday, I'm meeting some of them at a breakfast restaurant out in LaGrange. And maybe 3 or 4 of them are there with my sponsor, Paul, who at that time would have been 24 from 62. What is that? 38? You're sober. And we're sitting there, and I'm thinking it's over, and I'm going home. And they said, "Gary, take out your pad and your pencil again. We'll help you with your amends list." They had really good memories. And so we're writing down that. And Julie and I owed a lot of money. It wasn't that we had anything. We just owed it. We owed it to family, to AA members, to Dial Finance. You know, it was just all over the map. But I'm talking about the stuff from the old days. I'm not counting the current debt, the credit card and the car payment and the house and that stuff. And so they couldn't understand how I stayed sober. They believe if you don't finish your amends, you're going to die drunk. And they've got a lot of proof of that with the people they've worked at, that particular bunch. Now, I've been told by people, you're full of stuff, Brown. I have never done a step, and I'm just fine. What do you think of that? And boy, you got what I want, I'll tell you that. So so anyway, Julie and I sat down and went through our list. And she decided most of those were her amends, too, because a lot of that she was with me at the time and signed off on it. And she said, "No, we do have to get that taken care of. My wife's a step working big book, I don't know." And so that's what we did. And so on the following Tuesday night, we called up to her folks' house. And her dad answered the phone. And I told him, I told him why I was there. I wanted to try to set some things straight. I said, "But you got to understand that all these years that I was screwing up with at home there, and I know you were worried to death about your daughter and your granddaughters, the way I was treating them and the way we were living and that. And you never once said a cross word to me." And he didn't. He never did. There were times he wasn't overly nice and had good reason, but he never did that. I said, "I'm really grateful for that, and I love you." And he said, "Oh, shit," and he handed the phone to Grandma. And so I go through the same thing with her. And then I say... She did say some words in anger to me over the years. But anyway, I said, "Do you have any idea how much money you've given Julie and I over the years?" And she said, "Right down to the last penny." so we started making some arrangements to pay it back. And that was the beginning. The following Thursday, 2 days later, my father-in-law had a stroke and never recovered from it. He didn't get home from the hospital. And somebody mentioned that I probably needed to keep doing this thing, so I don't miss them all, I miss any more. And so that started off on the process of paying off the bills and doing that. I took an 18-column columnar pad, and I don't remember which order. I think the paydays or the people I owed were across the top, and then the dates would come down. And every payday, I'd go as far as the money would go down the list. And then I'd keep enough money for gas and groceries and maybe some the kids would need, and then would be broke till the next payday. And went all the way across and did that. And I'm up there one night several months later, and I come downstairs, and I'm frustrated, and I was looking for a little attention and sympathy. And I said, I don't think I'm capable of making enough money ever to make all these amends. And I was just frustrated. I just sitting down. I don't even think I had an intention to quit doing it. I was just voicing it. Next morning we got up, and Julie says, I have an idea. When they say something like that, you be careful. Her idea was that I had had the same job for a number of years, probably as long as I'd ever worked anywhere in my life, and I had a retirement going and a 401k and that. We lived in the same home for a number of years, and it had appreciated substantially. She says, we could sell the house, cash out the house, we could cash in your retirement, and pay off all those amends and the current debt, and buy a trailer house. And I thought, oh God, she can't be serious. But I knew she was. And so I hurried up and went to work. I don't get to work early very often, but I did that day. Got back, and I said, well, let's call Paul and see what he says. Because I thought, sure, he had a better answer. I called him, and so I ran it by him, and I said, how loco does that sound? And he says, Gary, that's the same thing you said in 20 years. Was it your idea? And I said, no, it was Julie's, and he said he thought so. So we did that. It took a few months to sell the house, and time went by, and it went good. And then the greatest day of the life came, because I got to call a bunch of these people and track them down. One of them was a guy in Laramie who had hired me as a student, and because I was older than most of the students here, he'd leave me to run the clothing store, men's clothing store, supervising other students and that. And he trusted me there, and I paid him back by stealing all the clothes I could get, and left Laramie one of the best-dressed graduating seniors you ever saw. And so I called him, and he said, Gary Brown, he says, are you still going to those meetings? Yeah, that's why I'm calling. And so I run it by him and told him and all that, and we figured out that the dollar amount I'd probably taken and made arrangements to start paying it back $50 a month, which is tokenism, but that's all I could do. And we struggled with that, and I missed a payment with him one time. He called me, wanted to know where it was. And I told him, I says, I just didn't get a commission check. I couldn't pay him. But I got to do it. This is going to get paid, John. I just have to do it. He says, not to me, you don't. But you got to promise me you're going to pay the rest of it. And so I thanked him and promised him that I'd do that. And so later on, the house sells, and I'm calling everybody. And I tracked John down, and I said, where's your ad? Give me your address. I got the money to pay you. He gave me the address. He forgot he forgave me. And so we sent him a check. And I called a guy in St. Paul, Minnesota, that many of you know. He's been on the circuit a long time. And Bob and I had met in Houston at an international young people's conference. And we just like each other. We very seldom see each other, talk on occasion and all that, but we're fond with each other. I'm backtracking here a little bit, but we were such friends that he called one day and was going to talk somewhere on the East Coast and said he thought he'd stop by Indianapolis and see us. So fine, great, good to see him. So I meet him at the airport, and he looks me in the eye, and he says, "What the hell is the matter with you? You look terrible." And so I told him, I says, "Well, I'm in real trouble financially. They're going to foreclose on the house tomorrow, and Julie doesn't know that, and I'm afraid it'll kill her." And just telling him, I got some relief. I wouldn't tell anybody in AA. I was too cool to do that. I was sober longer and more of them. You don't tell them anything if you've got your foot in the hole. And so we go on to, we drive by downtown to get to the home I had there in Indianapolis. And Bob says, "Where's the bank?" And I said, "What bank?" He says, "The one that has a note to your house." And I said, "It's right downtown here." And he says, "Let's go talk to them. Maybe we can do something about that house payment." I said, "Bob, they're really tired of talk. They don't want any more talk. I got to tell you that." And he said, "Let's go. You never know." I said, "Okay." So we park across the street. We're jaywalking to go into the bank. And I felt like those times where I was walking into to see the principal with my dad, you know. And the conversation is pretty short. He's sitting up by the desk, and I got my chair pushed as far back from the desk as I'm sitting. And a very angry-looking banker comes in with a stack of papers, and he sits down. And all Bob says to him is, "How much does it take to get Gary caught up?" And that big wrinkle up here just went away on that banker. He looked it up, and Bob peeled it off in traveler's checks and cash. And he had it in a wad in his pocket. I'm stunned, and we're walking back to the car. And I says, "Damn, Bob, I got to pay that back." And he said, "That's your problem." Boy, was he right. So anyway, now if you'll flash forward again, the day we sold the house and all that, I called Bob. And I said, "Give me your address. I'm in shape to get all that money back you gave me." And he laughed. And I said, "Well, what's so damn funny?" And he said, "Well, cowboy, it's like this. Back then, I had a business that generated cash faster than Linda and I could spend it." He says, everything was just going crazy. And so we had a tithe going, but we didn't want to give it all to the clubhouse or the church or whatever it is. So as he traveled the country, every once in a while, he would believe there really was an alcoholic in need that needed help. And so he was given, he said, "You're just one of those guys." He says, now Congress has, you know who I'm talking about, don't you? Congress changed the laws on syndicating various things such as real estate and oil wells and cattle and stuff. And when I called Bob, he said, "I'm in trouble now." He said, "The first time in years I've been on an allowance with this change in the laws. I got investors all over the country wanting their money back." And he says, "Well, I don't talk about this from the podium. I talk to my sponsor every day just to make sure I'm staying honest and upfront on these things." And he says, "I'll tell you something funny." He says, "Once or twice a week, I'll walk down to the mailbox to get the mail." And he says, "Very often there's a check in there." And he hadn't asked a soul for money from any of these people, and it was coming back. So you see, I got to be a part of a big deal, didn't I? AA's a big deal. The biggest deal is home in your home group. Please don't forget that. These things are wonderful, and you get a big charge, and you have a good time, and you get to see your friends, and you get elated. But sit up in your home group and look for the new person you can go help. I have guys that our process is what we do at home very often, is those of us that have a few people that we want to help them get through the book and the steps, we'll start a workshop, and we'll do it in about 12, 16 weeks, going through the book as anally as we possibly can. And showing them how to write inventory. Please quit giving your sponsors a kick in the ass and tell them to go write an inventory. Do it with them. Show them how to do it. God, think of the pain you wouldn't have had to deal with yourself if somebody had done that for you. Please do that. If you got an experience, share it. If you don't have an experience, get in a workshop and do it. But these guys will look in a meeting, and you can see the guys there. You can see the pain pouring out of the corner of their eyes, and they'll come up to you, and they'll say, "Hey, you don't have to call me sponsor, but can we just sit down once a week, and you and I can go through the big book together?" And the guy making the pitch might say, "My life depends on it." I think they hook a few more. when they say that, because their lives do depend on it. It's not a lie. So anyway, I find myself 47 years sober. Been in AA in Wyoming and Colorado. Oh, I didn't tell you, I did go back to Laramie and pay the group back. That was funny. They were happy to see me. It had been a couple of years, so I'd been there. They were happy to see me there. And just before the close of the meeting, when I was going to make my amend, old Frank got up and talked. He says, "You know, Gary, that's crazy. You know, we've always had money since you left." And I said, "Well, you know, Frank, that's exactly why I'm here." And so I told him that I had taken the money. Now, the thinking there says, I'm keeping track how much I'm taking out there, and I'm going to put it back. But it's not written down. There's no evidence I was keeping track of a damn thing. I was stealing it, period, with that. But it was kind of funny. So when I shared that with him, Frank said, "I thought so." And it worked out. What I can tell you with what I know now is I'm like Polly. I'm sober this long. I'm busier in AA than I have been in my life. It doesn't slow down a bit. I haven't thought of it that I got more to lose. I'm not sure that I do. But I still love it. I love everything about AA, and I wish I had more energy to do more of it, but I'd be doing it. To come here and be a part of this roundup has been wonderful. Everything about it has been great, and you people have been particularly loving and kind, and I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.